Let's start out with an embarrassing story. Online chess is the only video game I will let myself play. I've mostly avoided video games for nearly 15 years because I mostly just can't handle them. I lose hours of the day sucked into video games. When I used to play video games on a regular basis, my eyes would lock open as I stared at the screen, and my contacts would dry out because I would forget to blink. And sometimes, this is real, they would even pop out. So, no cell phone games for me, no computer games, just chess. The idea is that chess should be boring enough, slow enough, that it shouldn't have any of the addictive qualities of other games. And yet, online chess hates me. They have caught up with the video game world, and there are chess mini games and fast games and all sorts of features designed to keep you playing all day long. And one morning, I was finishing getting ready to walk out of the house when I thought to myself, self, I should play a quick game of chess. Now, I didn't have much time, but I had seen that there was a quick 1 minute version of the game, and so I played a game. And the 1 minute time limit was kind of exhilarating. I lost because I ran out of time. So I thought, that was really fast, but I think I have time for another. So I played another, and this time I won. Barely, with a fraction of a second left, and my heart was racing. It was so close. And at that point, I still had the ability to pull away, but I didn't. I didn't need to leave the house quite yet, so best 2 out of 3. I played the third game, and the moment I clicked on the third game, I was done for. I sat down, always a bad sign. And I knew I wasn't going anywhere for a while. Over the next 3 hours, I felt gross. In fact, those 3 hours sent me into a day-long depression. Because over and over I said, last game, or after the next win, or this is it. But I was way too stimulated. This 1 minute timer had hacked into my brain and my heart and my body, and I felt trapped, addicted, like a slave. Here is the embarrassing part of the story, you know, besides the fact that I was playing online chess. This was 2 weeks ago. I have been at this Jesus thing for like nearly 20 years now, and I think I should be well past uncontrollable video game binges, right? And well, this 3 hour chess binge was during one of the busiest weeks of the entire year. And I didn't have 3 hours to lose, and yet here I was indulging myself, gratifying the flesh and feeling powerless over it. The flesh. The flesh, what a strange word, first of all, right? We don't really use it much these days in ordinary conversation. It's an old translation of the Greek word sarx. Turn to the person next to you and say sarx. Turn to the other person next to you and say sarx, sarx. Sarx is an anatomy word. It refers to our physicality, our bodies, and it's used in a number of ways throughout the Bible. It can refer to humanity. So that the Bible can refer to all flesh and just mean all people, right? Or the Word could become flesh and dwell among us. Or as Paul will develop in his letters, the flesh can refer to something that has gone terribly wrong in our good and God-designed bodies. Paul will say things like, We were living in the flesh, our sinful passions. Or he'll say, nothing good dwells in my sinful flesh. Or those who are in the flesh cannot please God. And then he says, make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. Notice, right? The way that Paul qualifies the flesh in each of these statements, passions that miss the mark are the flesh. He describes them as sinful. He says they do not please God, that they are desires that are somehow disordered. Paul can talk about the body all the time in other sorts of positive ways, but he understands that our bodies have been invaded, that our bodies have been taken over by passions, by desires, by impulses, by forces that our bodies weren't designed for, that they ultimately can't handle, that ultimately lead us toward death. The last couple weeks, we have been exploring together the lies of the devil, the real danger of the devil's lies isn't that the devil lies to us and then we act on the lie, and then the devil lies to us again and we act on that one as well. See, the danger is that we begin to live the devil's lives, that each lie begins to work its way into our bodies, forming deep habits, the way that a sled will form deep grooves again and again if you keep riding it down the same path down a snowy slope. So that even when we see the lies for what they are, lies from the pit of hell, we can't shake them from our lives. The grooves are too deep. We can't simply think our way out of them. We can't simply decide our way out of them. We need to undo the power of the flesh. We need to learn to walk by the Holy Spirit. A few weeks ago, when I introduced this six-week series on the enemies of our spiritual lives, I confessed that in my teaching, in my own life, and just my general understanding of spiritual growth, the flesh is easily the spiritual enemy that I have neglected the most. My personal approach to the flesh has been just avoid temptation. So I don't have video games around my house, right? My devices all have content blockers on them. Our home internet turns off at 10 p.m. I have spent years trying to manage the flesh by avoiding temptation, by keeping the flesh away from anything that would entice it. But one of the things that God has started to teach me is that I've neglected self-control as a fruit of the Spirit. Now, this has to be said. To call something a fruit of the Spirit makes clear that self-control is a gift from God. Right? So self-control isn't something that I attain. It's not something that I get through hard work. It's not a self-improvement life hack. And yet, it is clear that the fruit of the Spirit are received and cultivated through our activity as we live in certain ways. So think about it like this. If you are a harsh person, you don't develop the fruit of gentleness by avoiding people that make you the most frustrated. You learn to be gentle in relationship with the people who frustrate you the most. You prepare for those interactions by praying. You imagine in your mind new ways of engaging with frustrating people. And then you practice those conversations with others in advance. And then when you show up, you are aware of the Holy Spirit's presence in that moment. You're aware of the Holy Spirit's power at work in you. And then you do your best. And at least early on, your best probably won't be good enough. You will probably fail to be gentle more often than not. And that is where we hear Spirit of God inviting us to confess that we've fallen short, that we've sinned, and we turn again away from a spirit of harshness toward our gentle Spirit of God, and then we do it all over again. Gentleness isn't something you experience alone, and it's not something that God just like does to you. Makes you gentle suddenly after a life of learning to respond harshly to people. And it will never be learned as you pray by yourself, God, help me be less harsh. The same goes for self-control. I am learning that self-control cannot be developed by simply avoiding all temptation. And yet, hear this, right? If you don't have the fruit of self-control in your life, you probably also shouldn't be racing into tempting situations. There is a place for avoiding temptation if you don't yet have self-control. In fact, our denomination, the Church of the Nazarene, was originally established as a refuge for alcoholics. It's why we don't have wine at our communion table. The founders of our church wanted to create a space for addicts to experience the full and the abundant life of Jesus. Create a space where people could learn to walk by the Spirit and live in a community of the Father's love. And having a place free from the temptation of alcohol was an important part of that in a culture where alcohol was pervasive. When it comes to addiction, the spirit might be willing, but the flesh is far too weak to face temptation head to head. So this creates a really important like tension and then question for us. Like, how do we then grow in self-control if we're actively avoiding the temptations that we're too weak to overcome? Did you follow that? I mean, think, how do we grow in self-control if we're actively avoiding the temptations that are going to overtake us probably? I mean, how do we learn to walk by the Spirit rather than walk by the flesh without setting ourselves up for all kinds of unnecessary sin and pain? The early church had an answer to these questions. The early church saw the answer, at least the starting place, as fasting. Fasting. The earliest Christians would refrain from eating food on a regular basis. This is what we call fasting. In fact, it was really common for Christian communities to fast together on Tuesdays and on Fridays every single week. This was normal for most Christians. When you read the writings of the early church, those that we have from the earliest writers, you get a sense of why this practice was so important. See, they saw this act of self-denial, this act of fasting tied to something as basic and as necessary as food. They saw this as a gateway for self-control. If you could deny yourself food, something so basic and ordinary, all other things could follow. So here's the thing. I feel so utterly unqualified to talk to you about fasting at all. As a brand new Christian, I fasted off and on for a few years, but I never really understood it. And by the time I was like 20 or 21, I had mostly stopped. It was just too uncomfortable. And now I'm 38 years old, and other than a handful of 30-hour fasts I did with my youth group, the last 11 weeks are legitimately the first time I've ever fasted consistently and on purpose. Jane will tell you sometimes I miss meals. That's just because I get distracted by people. So it's not real fasting. Now, every week, I try to talk myself out of it. Every Thursday, I can come up with 7 or 8 different, perfectly legitimate reasons why I should definitely not fast this week. And yet, week after week, aware the Holy Spirit has been dragging me into this, I've stuck with it. And can I just admit something to you? One of the reasons I started fasting is because I knew this sermon was coming. I knew that our small groups starting in June were going to be fasting together. This was all preordained, planned months in advance. But I knew that fasting has been mostly an intellectual idea for me. If you had asked me why fasting was important, I could have quoted Bible verses to you and explained it. But none of that would have come from experience. I started fasting because I didn't want to be an even bigger hypocrite than I already felt I was. In our small groups, we are going to explore how to fast. But here in just my final few minutes, I want to say 2 things about why we might fast. I've already spent most of my time kind of making the case that we need something to help break us free from the flesh's power. And maybe in what I've shared so far, you could identify places where the flesh clearly has power in your life. But so why fast? And let me offer you these final 2 thoughts on how and why fasting helps set us free from the flesh. The first is connected to food, just being a completely normal and necessary part of our lives. Right? We need to eat. But we don't often consider the ways that we've trained our body to eat. We have nurtured certain tastes. We've nurtured certain cravings. We have trained our bodies to expect food at certain times. When you start to feel hungry at lunchtime or whatever is a normal, consistent daily time, when you start to feel hungry, it's not because you must now eat or else. Those hunger pangs are learned. Your body is simply alerting you that this is normally when you eat. Our bodies are always alerting us to these sorts of normal habits. And here's the thing. We are used to listening to our body's alerts. Whatever our body wants, we go, oh, it wants it. Then must need it. Here it goes. Whenever the body wants it, we respond. When you choose not to eat at a certain normal time, you are throwing your body's alert system and automatic response mechanism into chaos. It doesn't know what to do. It has to recalibrate. You are training yourself around the truth that not every ping and pang is something to obey. Ultimately, you are retraining your body, the body that we are called to love God with our whole hearts, mind, soul, and strength, our body. You are retraining your body around a new answer to the question, do your hunger pangs serve you, or do you serve your hunger pangs? You might know the right answer in your head, but if every time you feel hungry, you eat, then your body is answering according to the flesh, not the spirit. If you can learn this truth with something as important with food, that the early church believed you would find yourself learning to say no to every other ping and pang. Self-control will begin to grow roots which will allow self-control to flower in other areas of your life. The early church believed that the starting place was fasting and with food, and that this would have an impact on every other thing that the flesh desired in a disordered way. Okay, so that's the first thing. Fasting gives you real practice saying no to good things so that you're ready to say no to harmful things. But here's the second gift that comes with fasting. You open yourself up to God. You show up present to God in ways that you couldn't have imagined and couldn't have prepared for. And so let me finish with a story. Lent, the season of Lent was almost over several weeks back. I had started fasting on Fridays through the season of Lent. And as we made our way through the final week of Lent, Holy Week, I realized that my final fast was going to be on Good Friday. And I had a lot of work to do on Friday to make sure that our service was ready in the evening. And so I considered, as I did every week, not fasting. Ultimately, I realized that God was inviting me to draw near to Him. He was inviting me to learn in that moment what it meant to trust Him as my strength for the day. And so I reluctantly went ahead with the fast. But then I faced another dilemma. I normally on Fridays break my fast with dinner on Friday nights. So I had the important question, do I eat before service or do I wait until after service? Everything inside of me said, eat first. I would clearly need the energy for service. I needed to be mentally sharp. And sometimes when I fast, I actually can feel a little fuzzy in my head. But again, I sensed God's Spirit urging me this time to fast a little longer. I assumed that maybe God just was, you know, bulking me up spiritually, strengthening my fasting muscles, increasing my capacity to fast, something like that. I didn't realize that God had a different kind of surprise waiting for me. So that night comes, service starts, and before I realize it, we were receiving communion. I hadn't even considered it, even though I had planned for us to receive communion, but I was holding a piece of bread and a cup in my hands, and I was aware that this would be the first thing I had eaten or drank in over 24 hours. And then as I ate and as I drank, I experienced this deep sense of satisfaction wash over me. And through the rest of the service that night, it felt like I was genuinely feeding on every word and image. Something about the story of Jesus on the cross, the songs and the prayers and the songs, all of it fed me. And after the service, Jane came up to me and asked if I was ready to go eat dinner, that I must be starving by now, but I wasn't. I genuinely felt full, content, satisfied in a way that I hadn't before. I had experienced the truth in Jesus' words that He spoke to His disciples when He said, I have a food to eat that you do not know about. I experienced the truth that we do not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from God. Those passages that I knew were becoming real to me in that moment in a profound way. So that after 7 weeks of fasting, I had started to learn to say no to some good things. And fasting for those 7 weeks had helped open me to a new and a profound experience of being satisfied by God and His presence with me. And it's utterly humiliating in, you know, those ways that you're embarrassed to think that in a moment like that of such deep satisfaction, fulfillment with God, that a couple weeks later, I could waste 3 hours of my life playing online chess. I can promise you, there was nothing satisfying about that. Hyper-stimulating for 3 hours, but nothing satisfying. How powerful the flesh is in drawing us into stimulating experiences that will never satisfy. So after 7 weeks of fasting during Lent, I decided to stick with it a little longer. I'm gonna keep fasting, for one, because I'm terrible at it and I wanna be better, just being honest, but mostly because I sense God drawing me to himself through it. I have no idea what God is going to do in my life or ours as we fast in our small groups, but I'm open to wherever the Spirit leads. And speaking of the Spirit's leading, once again, the Spirit of Jesus is leading us to come, to gather around his table, to remember, to eat. At his table where he is king and where love reigns. I'm gonna ask our team to come and prepare to lead us in our next song. As they do, in this moment, I just want to create some space for some silence. What do you need to hear the Spirit saying this morning? What is the Spirit of God calling you to? Where does the flesh still have great power over your life? Do you believe this morning that through Christ's death and resurrection, he has defeated the devil, the powers and principalities of darkness, whatever spiritual forces would war against you, they have already been shown to be empty? So if today you are continuing to serve the flesh, know that Jesus has set you free from it. He's opened the prison door. He's given you, by his Spirit, the means of breaking the power of the flesh, of living into the fullness of God's design for your life, a life that will flourish, that will bring love and light into the world and into others' lives. Whomever the Son sets free is free indeed.